Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Since 71 podcast. I've got to say, this is an episode that I've been really excited to record. Today, we welcome former Scotland international and former Team G player, Ifeoma Daiki. You can probably just correct my pronunciation there if you like, Ify, because I've probably butchered it. So I apologize straight away off the bat.
No worries. No one even calls me that, so I don't know if anyone recognises my full name, but Ify is, that's fine.
And with us today, we have one of our other Since 71 contributors, Daisy. Daisy's making her podcast debut, and she's going to be giving me a little bit of support while we catch up with Ify and find out all about her career, and paying particular attention to the London 2012 Team GB experience that she had. But how are you doing today, Daisy? You well?
I'm good, thank you, yeah.
Excellent. So we'll jump straight into it. So just to start off with, Ify, could you tell us a little bit about yourself with regards to what sort of position you played on the pitch and your character in the match?
Obviously, when I first started out, playing, I think, right wing back in the day. And just throughout the years, different coaches, whether it was injuries, I got slid back into centre-half. And that's where I ended up playing most of my career, especially with Scotland and then obviously club. And obviously, hence, you know, maybe that's where I was selected also for Team GB. So just throughout the years, you know, played every position. Then obviously, as you go back, you understand the game a bit better and work with different coaches and you see a game from a different point of view. So I wouldn't say I was a hard-nosed defender. I would have said that I was more of a, you know, stand-up defender and always worked well with my centre-half partners who were, you know, who we complemented each other well with, whether it was Shirley Kerr, who was more robust, Rachel Corsi. But again, it was just that balance, that relationship. And definitely one that probably used my head a lot more, didn't get a lot of bookings as I played. Quick and I think able to read the game pretty well.
So you find that experience playing further up the pitch helped with your time at the back? You knew what your teammates would want from you?
Yeah, exactly. Especially, I think, in possession, you know, in terms of different angles, what position they'd be looking to receive the ball, things like that. And, you know, when you put yourself in someone else's shoes, you know, it's easier to, you know, like to then understand the game a lot more. So I think that definitely helped me playing, you know, whether I played, you know, defensive midfield, played on the wing, you know, obviously in the Cyprus, I played as a forward. So I had a lot of fun, you know, playing different positions. And then just eventually, as I got older, you know, went back, further back, as they say. But I enjoyed my time, obviously, because again, back there, you know, as you're playing, it becomes more about reading the game and it becomes more about being more vocal, which when I was younger, I wasn't very vocal. But as I got older, I, you know, learned off of, you know, like the older players and began to talk. And then obviously by talking and communicating and moving people about, that also helps you and helps the team out because before it even gets to you, you can, you know, like we can move them around like chess pieces. So I think that's important to have that, you know, that communication and leadership, especially from a central position in the back.
Definitely. I tend to drop my Saturday youth team into podcasts quite regularly. My Havant and Waterlooville under 15 girls. And that's the exact message we're trying to get across at the moment. A lot of my players have only been playing for 2-3 years. And while they're picking up the skills fantastically well, they're still very silent on the pitch and they're just starting to realise you get that communication, it kind of knits everything together and it just makes the game easier to play.
Yeah, definitely. Save your legs, you know. Maybe people would say that I don't like to run much. I can run, you know, but, you know, if you can move people about, then it saves you. It definitely saves your legs and saves your energy and things like that. So use your brain more, but that's also a good thing.
And a good leader delegates. So if you've got someone that you think's a bit sprightlier, then you can certainly delegate that to them. So and obviously your amount of experience. What I find really interesting about your career is obviously you grew up in Scotland. Am I right?
Yeah.
But did you play it? You didn't play for any Scottish teams, did you? Well, not professionally.
No, I mean because obviously back then there wasn't Hank and. Because I played I think, under 13 at Cumbernauld Cosmos, and then they had an under 16 team. And after under 16, it was just like, you know, an open age. So I was only there, you know, because we were very successful, obviously a little town outside of Glasgow, very successful, you know, the 13s, the 16s. And then when I went to the Cumnall Ladies, you know, at 16 years old, I was competing with, you know, players probably 20, like 8 to 10 years older than me. But that, for me, definitely stood me in, like, good stead because you got in a, you know, a changing room at 16 and obviously I was in awe, like, a total respect for, you know, my elders, you know, grown women who had been playing a long time, obviously more, like, more physically developed than me. Stronger. And so that also, as a youngster, you've got to, you know, like, it teaches you a lot. And, you know, we had a great, you know, a great changing room, a lot of, you know, a lot of characters, which, you know, when I look back on, it was like, you know, two of the best years that I had, you know, not just on the pitch, off the pitch, successful, you know, but great, you know, great leaders, role models and players that when I was under 16 that, you know, they would come in, have conversations with us and like we were starstruck because that's what you aspire to be. You want to be not just in that team, but, you know, be accepted, which is the biggest thing. And, you know, now being a part of that, being a part of that success, you know, you want to be able to, you know, get in there, get your head down and work hard so that you'd be accepted. And that definitely stood me in good stead for the 2 years that I played with Cumnall Ladies. And then also took into the fact that, you know, I got the scholarship and I was able to, you know, come in America, come to Miami, and then basically further my footballing journey for there.
So it's obviously quite a common road for female footballers to go over to the States because of the quality of the coaching, the quality of the facilities and the investment in the players and the teams. Did you ever see a pathway to professional football remaining in the United Kingdom?
No, not at that time, not in the 90s. I think back in the '90s, it was all about, you know, sitting around the Americans being the, you know, the best athletes, the best mentality. And, you know, for me, when I was in Scotland, having played for 2 years, you know, we won the treble 2 years in a row. And even at 18 years old, I felt I couldn't go any further in Scotland. And so for me, it was always had the ambition to test myself, you know, against the best. And at that time, it was being in America. So there was always the thought of, you know, getting to America. And there was always the scholarship way. And having players on my team that had gone over to Miami during the summer for a couple of summers and played semi-pro. So that was that's how Miami got in my head, because they would talk about their experiences like that. And Miami's a far cry from, you know, Glasgow, the weather and just everything. And, you know, I remember also, you know, Will Smith's video, Miami, Welcome to Miami, and seeing that and just thinking how amazing that would be to go from Cumbernauld to Miami. And the coach for my players, my teammates who played semi-pro, he was English. So he had come over, watched the game, and just from there, it was a semi-final, I did all right. And then he basically started talking to me and asking me, you know, like if I'd fancied, you know, coming over to Miami, a scholarship, and just, you know, things fell in place that way. And then, of course, you know, there's a difference in the system in terms of the schooling, the thing, the test that you have to take, and also knowing that, you know, looking at the school to see what degree I'd be interested in taking, which was also, which was important to my family, you know, that, you know, I'd combine my studies as well as the footballing aspect. So everything was a win-win situation. And, you know, then I mean, even going into that, I had no idea how far I could go. I just thought the next step from playing, you know, with the females was to come to Miami, and then that's about as far as it got to. And then obviously things kind of snowballed and took off and went well for me, I guess.
So obviously when you were growing up, who was your biggest footballing inspiration?
It's a good one. I would say it was really looking up to, you know, the men's teams. You know, I was from when I lived in England for a few years, something about watching Manchester United resonated with me. I just remember, you know, watching them a game. I think it was Man United playing Norwich, and something about that just, you know, I was. That's when football somehow grabbed me, and obviously learning about Sir Alex Ferguson being from Scotland, things like that, and then I just watched Man United. So growing up and watching United play through the years, it was players like, you know, for me, Roy Keane, Eric Cantona. I remember the World Cup 94, watching Brazil play, you know, watching Romario, Bebeto, players like that. So it was a lot of the male, you know, the male players, because I don't remember, you know, even if you're thinking about, you know, the US winning the World Cup in 99, that's not televised all the way in Scotland. So a lot of the things that you see, you know, in Scotland was, you know, the male game, which is, you know, like, if you love football, you enjoy that. And so you always aspire to play football, not knowing that, you know, females can. But obviously nowadays, you know, there's a lot more female role models and that, you know, females can actually relate to. Not saying that they can't relate to the men's, but when you see someone that, you know, is female like you, that's done it, been there, done that, that's definitely maybe more inspiring than the men's game, which is a little bit different from the women's game.
So you were born in the United States to Nigerian parents, but moved to Scotland when you were 3 years old. So you could have qualified for all three different nations, but you opted to represent Scotland. Was there ever any question of which country you'd want to represent?
Not really. I would say when I was playing football, it wasn't like playing international football wasn't something that I'd even focus on or something that I was like, oh, I want to play for, you know, this country or whatnot. I was just happy playing football. So once I had that, that was all that mattered. As only as, you know, things progressed, I think obviously I had teammates from the Scottish national team that would always say to me, but until I think the coach Vera Powell had reached out, I think the second time, it was one of those conversations because the league had folded here and things like that. Then it became right, you know, thinking about international football. And I got invited over to a couple of camps with Scotland, which obviously I knew, you know, the players, having grown up with them, playing with them, against them. So that was just an easy fit, really. And then it was a few months into having been with a couple of camps with at Scotland that my former coach at university had contacted April Heinrichs, the US coach at that time. And so the plan was to go into camp with the US for a couple of weeks in, you know, California, just to, you know, just go into camp. And that was just something that it was going to collide, obviously, with a European game for Scotland. But I was doing it. And then all of a sudden, like just as time like got approached and got closer, I wasn't excited about that prospect. And then came to a realization that, you know, if you're going to play for a country, you know, you have to. It's not like playing for a club team. You know, you've got to have that pride, that passion, that heart. And yeah, I was born in America, but I didn't feel American. So it would just be like, you know, ticking a box, but, you know, singing the anthem wouldn't have meant anything. Things like that. So obviously I had to make the phone call to April and just said, you know, thanked her for the opportunity. But I just came to the decision that, you know, I'm going to play for Scotland. You know, I felt Scottish. Having grown up there, everything about Scotland just, you know, just resonates with me. And, you know, I've got to be, you know, truthful to myself. It doesn't matter, you know, what the, you know, the opportunities or, you know, the financial stuff that comes with the USA. That's just not how I felt. And in terms of Nigeria, again, it was one of those things that no one ever reached out. So I never had a decision to make about Nigeria. Obviously, the two countries were obviously being in touch with the US and then obviously, you know, Scotland. So for me, it only came down between those two because that was the communication that I had back then.
I'm impressed that you've managed to keep your Scottish accent, to be honest. I travelled across America a couple of times when I was younger and it took me about 2 days before I started speaking in American twangs.
Nah, I've got an American accent. It's just that, you know, because again, if I speak to somebody from home, it's just like, it's easier. But over here, like when I went to, you know, college, the number of times I had to repeat myself over and over and over again and just like little words, like I remember I was like saying that, oh, you know, like let's meet in the car park. And they were like, what? I was like, the car park. And I didn't know the American phrase, how to phrase that in America, like, you know, how they said it. And I just couldn't understand that they can't understand something as simple as a car park.
How do they say it?
And then a parking lot.
Oh, I guess, yeah.
You mean a parking lot? I'm like, how do you not get car park from parking lot? You park your car in the car park. But, yeah. You know, so all these little subtle, so like sudden different changing words, phrases, things like that. And then over time, it's like a light switch. I can go from, it's easier to go from American English to Scottish, but then to try and get back to American English, I've got to kind of think about it a little bit more, but it's more natural to just be like, right, Scottish. So I remember, again, you know, because I was working with Amazon a little bit and someone's like, oh, like, we want to hear your accent. Certain words they can hear. And so I was speaking Scottish and whatnot, and I was training somebody in there, and I was just thinking, I can't get back to my American accent. I just don't know how to do it. And they were just laughing at me because all of a sudden I've started training someone and I was speaking obviously American English, and then to come back 10 minutes later, it's just completely different accent. They'd just be like, what? So it's definitely more natural in the Scottish, but I try to, you know, like whether it's coaching, speaking to anybody, it's easier for the Americans with that. But there's obviously certain words that will always be, you know, like Scottish, and they'll be like, oh, I heard it there. And I'm like, well, that's just how we say things, you know.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. So moving on to London 2012, it kind of resonates quite a lot with me at the moment because we're on the cusp of the Team GB Tokyo Olympic team being announced. You were one of the only two non-English players that were selected for the London 2012 Team GB women's side. Could you tell me a little bit about how you first became aware that you were being considered by Hope Powell and the coaching team?
I remember, like, leading up to it, obviously, there was a lot of the, you know, debates and the political things about, you know, like, will Scottish players play, you know, the FIFA stuff, like, would they take away, you know, Scotland's independence, and would they all be, things like that. So there's all those, like, things lingering on. And for me, I was always the mindset that, you know, I left, because it was always about leaving your name in the, you know, name in the ring, because at the end of the day, like, you don't have the decision to make if you're not selected. So, you know, I think, you know, I've spoken to, you know, obviously some of the Scottish players at the time, and it was just a case of, well, leave our name in, and obviously there's rounds that you go through for the cuts, and, you know, if I get selected, I'll get selected, and I've got a decision to make. But until then, there's no decision to make, so, you know, I don't even think about it. I just continue on, you know, playing, doing what I was doing. I think I was playing at Cyprus at the time. So I remember, I think before the announcement, I think it was a week before or a few days before or whatnot, it was Anna Signol who had just kind of given me a heads up that, you know, Hope Hill was going to be calling me, just saying that, you know, I've been selected. And it was just kind of like, you know, it was just like, oh, shoot, I'd be getting a call from Hope. And I was just like, wow. Because again, you leave your name in and you just think, don't know, I'm just one that just gets on with it and not even think about it. And you kind of forget about it because it's like months and months, like, you know, before. And so I remember getting the call that morning from Hope and just telling me that, you know, she'd like to select me. You know, obviously I would have to say yes and things like that. And it was just like, even though I knew it was coming, but it was just still like, wow, it's actually happening. And, you know, just, you know, and I just welcomed me to, you know, be a part of history and things like that. And it was just like, wow. And it was just like, got off the phone, had that moment to myself. And then obviously, you know, I spoke to, you know, my family were the only ones that I told. And then just wait for everything else to take place. And it was just, yeah, I couldn't believe it really still. Even looking back now too, it's just, I can still remember that conversation. I can still remember, you know, where I was and things like that. And yeah, just obviously like an honor to be even, like to be considered, but obviously to be selected and to be part of history, which, you know, when you look back on, I'm just thinking that's, I think that's pretty cool. I'll look at that definitely and think that's cool.
During that time you were playing abroad, were you taken by surprise that Powell and the FA team were considering players playing outside of the UK?
I don't think I was taken aback. Obviously I played, having that international experience I think definitely helped, and maybe they're reckoning because obviously playing the Olympics is worldwide. And obviously I knew about, you know, Anita Satney, who had played in America and things like that. So being in touch with her and I think, you know, having that, you know, international experience was maybe, you know, a key element. Maybe had I been playing in Scotland, I wouldn't have been selected. So I think that I wasn't taken aback by that, no.
What were your first thoughts when you discovered that you had been selected into the final squad?
Just one of joy, really. Just thinking, I'd grown up obviously watching the Olympics, you know, from a kid, and everybody watches it every 4 years. You know, sit down with my family, you know, the track and field events is the biggest thing for me. So knowing that, you know, I'd be part of that, and you know, you said to me, you know, I think when you said to me, if someone had said to me, one, you know, like I'd play for Scotland, I wouldn't have believed them. If you said that I'd be being selected for the Olympics, you know, way down the line, I'd just tell them to shut up. So it's just one of absolute joy, like pride and, you know, just an, like I said, a real honour and pleasure that, you know, that I was selected.
And you were no stranger to the international setup and had over 100 caps for Scotland. Did the Team GB meetup feel similar to the experience of Scotland or being in the Olympics? Was it something altogether more unique?
It was more unique in so many ways. I think, obviously, being part of the international setup, you know, we'd never gotten a tournament. So this was like the first time, you know, that, you know, myself and Kim, we'd gone to, like, been in like a tournament football. Things like that, but it was like for games, two games and things like that, but being like away, like in a bubble, the organization of London 2012. So it was a new experience in that way, but one that, you know, we were helped along the way to, you know, to navigate.
Obviously, you've touched on the fact you were one of only two non-English players selected. Was that something you felt conscious of?
Nah, not really, because when it comes down to it, I think a lot more was made of that from, I think, from the media side, because it's obviously, you know, mainly English players. But I didn't look at it that way and be like, oh, I'm just, you know, one of two. Because, again, I knew a lot of the players going out in the squad. Haven't played with them, haven't played against them. So it wasn't going to be anything of a shock or a surprise to us knowing that, you know, we knew the players. So it was more comfortable that way. Obviously, didn't know the coaches. Didn't really know, you know, the coaching styles, how they worked, because, you know, we've played for, obviously with Scotland it's different, or my club it's different. So just the coaching side was the hardest part, just to see like, well, what Hope wanted from, you know, from the team, the squad, the setup, and that's the only thing that was difficult.
Obviously, Powell described you as great at 1v1 defending, that you can play anywhere across the back. What influence does she have like on your game?
The biggest thing is, you know, I remember, you know, when women's football was rarely on TV, you know, when Hope played at Wickham, you know, watching her play, you know, having known, you know, the background that she had as a player, even playing for England and things like that, and, you know, watching her with Gillian Coulthard and a lot of the, you know, the great, you know, English players that, you know, you see playing. So there's a lot of respect that way, in just watching her develop and then watching her going out in the coaching and being successful with England. So there's that admiration for me that, you know, you look at not even just, you know, players who have played, but what she's done is her time. So I think you always pick up things from a coach, and especially players who have had the experience in the game and obviously, you know, did well as a player. And so just working alongside her, you know, it was just it opened up my eyes a little bit more on the, I would say, the tactical aspect, and, you know, her using her experiences and, you know, even working with, you know, Casey Stoney as well, you know, and being like in that mold that I'd played with whether it was like Shelley Kerr and things like that. So that just thought, I think that every time you work with a coach, it does make you better, you learn a lot more. And so I took a lot of that into my, from her into my game. And, you know, she was definitely tough but demanding. But you always want that from a coach.
You've obviously touched on two great defenders there in Shelley Kerr and Casey Stoney. Have you ever been surprised that they've gone on to do so well in club and international management respectively?
Not at all. I think out in the pitch when I was younger, you can see that in her, like the way that she commands, like, you know, like commands the pitch, you know, like directs everybody, organizes everything. She's like, you know, she wasn't a captain for no reason. And you can see that with her in her leadership style. So when she obviously became Scotland, yeah, even from going into the men's game, not surprised. And, you know, just the way she is, not surprised. And then also, for me, it was a natural fit when Anna left that it was going to be Shelley. You know, I could always tell that, you know, she was like a Scotland manager in waiting, you know, just like I think right now I could be like Rachel Cosse is like another one in Shelley's mold. And obviously having been in the setup with Team GB, playing alongside Casey, I see a lot of similarities in Casey as I do in Shelley. And so, of course, you know, she's gone on being successful, you know, obviously started out with Phil Neville and then gone on to, you know, great heights with Man United, you know, with only being a few years old. But not a surprise at all, just because of the way that they were on the pitch, and, you know, now that, you know, like now they're in charge of a club or running a team. So yeah, it was just natural.
So talking about centre backs you've played with that have gone on into management to do well, Another centre back you played with, Steph Houghton. Could you see her making that transition as well?
Definitely. Steph is, I think, after actually London 2012, like, she's gone on from, like, Aunt and Big. Obviously, she scored the goals and all the attention came on her, rightly so. But, you know, she started out, like, she played left back, obviously, for Team GB, and then obviously was at Arsenal for a number of years. And I think maybe going out in Man City, where she was a pivotal figure, like, as they started their team, and being, like, in that central position and being, like, you know, she's turned into, you know, quite the leader, quite the captain, and very important for club and country. And so not only her abilities on the pitch, but, you know, the things that she does off the pitch. So she's definitely, and everybody, you know, always talks about Steph, you know, Steph the player, but in terms of, you know, the hard work that goes into from her, and how she's had to, like, how she's worked even harder from 2012, because some people could have just stayed lost in that, you know, on that focus, stayed lost in that limelight, but she's actually taken it onto a completely different level. And, you know, for her looking at 2012 and going into now, like, she's a completely different player, more mature, more well-rounded, and, yeah, like, captain and leader.
You probably argue that, apart from maybe Kelly Smith, she's probably our generation's two biggest players, really, I guess.
Yeah, and the biggest thing with her is, like, she's been so consistent over a number of years. You know, obviously, I see this season she's got, you know, a couple of injuries, but up until then, you know, she's every game starts Man City, same with England, and maybe even looking at the England results, the last few results, and with her not being around, maybe that's also shown, you know, like, how important she is to England. Because, you know, as you get older, it's like, you know, people start talking about replacing you and things like that. But, you know, age is just a number, as long as, you know, you still have that desire and things like that. So, you know, when you start to get over 30s, you know, people, you know, start writing you off and whatnot. And it's only maybe when you're not around that they actually see the real importance and how you are. Because maybe players will bypass centre-halves and be like, you know, look at the midfielders, look at the forwards, the more glamorous positions and things like that. But, you know, to have your leader and your captain who's back there, who's been there, done that through a number of years at the highest level too, club and country, then it's like, right, actually, she is quite important no matter what other new centre-halves are actually coming along. Because nothing, like, replaces experience in my book. You know, like, you can have the up-and-comers, but you've been there, done that, tournament football, captain, like I said, and maybe she's shown, like, how important she is actually to England, with them, like, not having her around.
Definitely. Well, I was up in Stoke-on-Trent on Tuesday for the match, and she probably was missed, to be honest. But we're all human, unforced errors. Let's get them out of the way before the Team GB comes around. That's the whole point of friendlies, isn't it? Am I right?
Yeah, definitely.
You know. Definitely. So talking about, getting back to yourself, really, you made your debut with Team GB against Sweden at the Riverside Stadium in Middlesbrough. What are your overriding memories of that game?
It was one of just, like, you know, for me, it was just, like, try and keep it simple, you know. You know, walking in, you know, I remember trainings, you know, the trainings were a completely different way from, you know, if I try to compare it, it's Scotland, you know, but it's hard to compare it because it's, when it's two different coaches, two different styles, it's like coming in a completely new ball game, no matter if you knew the players or not. You know, it's about, you know, they had the advantage, I would say the English players had the advantage of knowing how, you know, Hope and her coaching staff worked. So it was kind of coming in, learning from her as soon as possible, because it's like, right, spotlight's on everybody, you know, but I'm not just here to then, like, make up numbers. You want to then push and, you know, to be in that starting lineup. So then it's like, you know, you have to focus on the details more, ask more questions, you know, maybe instead of, like, you know, off the pitch, you know, relaxing, you're, you know, staying tuned, because you want to, I wanted to be, like, in that starting lineup that first game. So then, you know, obviously you have the opportunity, like, yeah, we've trained. And like I said, it was a case of, you know, thinking of the qualities, like, what led me to be selected. Like, you know, nothing for me has to change because, you know, like, the reasons why I was selected is the reasons why I'm here. So I have to keep it simple and, you know, like, work with my centre-half, work with whoever I was going to be thrown with, work with my defence, to then be able to communicate, to then be, you know, aggressive in my defending and then relax in possession. So I remember that game going in and just thinking, you know, going through my usual rituals of what I go into every game. So again, nothing changes in terms of my mentality, my focus, my preparation, that happened. And like maybe I had a bit of a upper hand, you know, maybe that was a good game for me, it being Sweden, because obviously having played in Sweden, excuse me, I knew the players, so I knew the opposition I was coming up against. So without, you know, the scouting report, without all the videos and things like that, I knew, like, you know, the quality of the players I was going to face. So in terms of, you know, like, I think I remember going up against Sofia Jakobsen, Lotte Kalin, things like that. I knew their quality. So that also helps me as a defender to be, like, right, to be more determined and more focused and, you know their movement. And I think that game, I think I did all right. I think I was, you know, they said I was player of the game or something like that. So I think, yeah, that was a good first game. And then that just helped me in terms of confidence, knowing that, right, obviously I know my qualities, but it's more about putting it into a new team setting. And then obviously it's like on a big stage. So that definitely, you know, helped me settle more in the team and then just have the confidence going there from there on.
Were your family able to come down and watch any of the games?
I believe my mum and dad were in Nigeria, but I had like some family and my brother came down for the first two games and had friends as well, so the first two games. So yeah, because obviously it's local, as you say. So yeah, they were able to drive down and come down to some games.
And so you obviously went into the Olympics with only one competitive game together as a team. I wondered if there was a feeling within the squad that you were satisfied, that you felt prepared after that, just a single game, or whether you felt that you were at a disadvantage over other teams?
We never thought about it or even talked about it. I think the way that, you know, because when we worked, and there was never the mindset of, well, we've not had the preparation, things like that. I don't think it was, I think, again, because it was mainly the England squad, so there's only a couple of players outside of that. And, you know, I think, you know, Kim, you know, she's intelligent. And she, again, she's played with a lot of those players and it's easy for her to go play anywhere. You know, I think, say, like, good players can always, you know, play together. And so there wasn't much of a tweak, say, from the England team. And so there wasn't that or that lack of preparation, because it's not like you're trying to, like, knit together, like, a completely brand new team by having like 6, 7, 8 players and come in and fit into your style. So I don't think that was never a talk. That was never an issue. Just in my head, I was just thinking, right, you know, they've got the upper hand, but you know, it's about me getting on board and then just try to, you know, like understand like what is expected from this team. So that was never, there was never a talk of we didn't play enough. Cause we worked a lot during, you know, training sessions. And, you know, to replicate the movements. And then, I guess, so that was enough.
And so you think it would be the same for the current team that are going to go to Tokyo, even though they've not had the preparation? You think with all the games within the Champions League and the WSL that they should be able, and the professionalism that they possess, they should be able to make that transition quite smooth?
I think it was going to be different for a number of reasons. I think back then, like, Hope had been the England manager for a number of years. So I think all the English players knew, you know, what to expect, the style of things like that. With Hege Riise only taking over not too long ago, you know, with the last couple of squads, she's had a lot of different players. She's had a lot of injuries. So they've not had like a solid group, really, to know the way that she wants to play. And then I think, if you're looking at selections, you know, for that, you know, there's going to be definitely more than two non-English players in that squad. So then that's going to be another added dimension where, you know, maybe if you're talking now, the English players, you know, haven't quite figured out, or not figured out, kind of got down how she wants to play first. So that's not knitted together as nicely, I would say, as it was in 2012. Then you're going to add into the mix of, you know, not non-English players, which, like I said, I believe is going to be more than two. I'd be shocked if there's not more than two, you know. So then you're going to add that into the frame. So then you're going to have a group of, I think it was 18 and 4 reserves, unless that's changed from back then. I don't know. And it might have changed because of COVID, I'm not sure. But you're going to have a bigger squad, and then you're thinking, not even the squad, then you're thinking first game, like, what players are you thinking of playing, what formation, and things like that. So I think there's going to be a lot more challenges this time around than there was last time. But you're still going to get the same preparation time because you'll have the FIFA windows that apply in terms of, you know, you're limited in, you know, what you can do. Because we had one official friendly. Obviously, you have like friendlies, like inter-squad friendlies and things like that. But again, these players are, you know, they're used to playing with each other, against each other. So in terms of the chemistry on the pitch, it's not going to be, again, good players can always play with good players, and there's enough good players available to have like the best squad possible going at that tournament.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's got to be more than two in this current squad. I can think of, at the very minimum, there's got to be at least two Scots players that are going to be in that squad, in Aaron Cuthbert and Caroline Weir. Just to name just the two.
Yeah. So, like, even, like, you know, people are saying, oh, it's just Scotland, but you got to look at also Wales also. I mean, Northern Ireland also just qualifying, you know, like, for their first Euros too. So, you know, you don't become, you've got to have some, you know, but it's also about a team, you know. Don't know what, you know, the selection process will be. I think they'll say the best players. I don't know if they'll look to, you know, pick players to represent all four nations and things like that. But, you know, there's good players in Wales, good players in Scotland, it's Northern Ireland, but it's about knitting together a squad. And is it going to be taking six players, seven players out of the 18? Is that too many changes to then, you know, knit together like a competitive quality squad that's going to compete right off the bat? So it just depends on how, you know, Hege Riise is thinking in terms of that. But right off the bat, you know, I'm thinking like Scottish players, you know, Caroline Weir, Erin Cuthbert, Kim Little, for sure. And then, you know, there's and then those three players right there as well, you know, they've had that relationship. You know, if I look at Kim Little, you know, she's been at Man City, so she's, you know, used to playing, not Man City, she's been at Arsenal, but she's used to playing with, you know, Steph. She's got that relationship with the Man City players that played at Arsenal. Even someone like Jennifer Beat, if you're looking at centre-half, because it's all about those relationships of those players. You know, she's been at Man City where she played with Steph. A lot of the Man City players have been at Arsenal. There's a lot of connection there. So if you're looking at connections and relationships on the pitch, you know, I would say those three players are the ones that got the most experience with a lot of the, you know, the players in the England squad. So I'd be shocked if those three are not in it. And then it's obviously quite, you know, there's, you know, like, you know, then you're thinking there's Beats in there. I know she's had a few injuries and things like that. But, you know, squad selection as well, it's one of those. There's a long time to go. You can get selected, you know, at the end of the month, but things change, injuries happen. So, you know, they'll have alternates that they're thinking of also. But I'm looking forward to it. You know, I think, you know, the quality is definitely a lot more. So the selection is going to be tougher. And it's not like when you go to the Euros or the World Cup, you've got a squad of 23. The Olympics, like I said, it's usually 18 and you've got four reserves. And I don't know if those numbers are different, like I said, with COVID.
I believe it's going to be the same. I think it's having that small squad.
Yeah, so as I'm saying, so obviously the Olympics is 18. Someone gets injured and it's one of those four right there. So with, like, I don't even remember last time that anybody had a squad of 18. But so the numbers are even tighter. And like every selection you have to be, yeah, you know. So again, that's not, I'm not the coach, so I've not got that problem. I'll just be sitting back and watching. But it's definitely going to be another unique experience. You know, one that, you know, players will be, you know, first time Olympians. There'll be second time Olympians as well. But just sit back, watch, and I'm sure it's going to be a tough decision, but it's going to be a competitive squad, that's for sure.
Do you think it'll be important for players who were in the 2012 TB squad to be picked up this time for the experience?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's no substitute for experience. And the Olympics is not like a Euros or a World Cup. It's definitely bigger. The things that are involved in terms of, say, even like the kitting out process, you know, so there's a lot of things that are so different than you don't, you know, having the players who've been there that can also help. So, you know, you're not overawed by the experience, you're not overawed by, you know, the requirements of, you know, Team GB and going through that process. I think that's going to be important. You know, having a good, you know, mix of, you know, experience will settle everybody down. And, you know, even going into the game, because again, you've played, you know, I think we played four Olympic games, important, and it'll be nervy because it's a new experience. But yeah, experience is definitely going to be key, I would say.
So you participated in the first two Team GB games, that friendly against Sweden and the first group stage game against New Zealand, at which point we hadn't conceded a goal. How are you feeling going into the second game against Cameroon?
Yeah, I think, you know, like the more you play together, and, you know, I always think that, you know, the foundation to, you know, success is always, you know, defensive solidity as a team. So going into the first game, obviously, it was just like the first game ever. There was a lot of attention. You know, I think at that point, you know, playing in front of 30,000 people was, you know, quite new. And just we didn't feel like there was pressure, but knew there was eyes on us for a number of reasons. So going in after that, knowing that, you know, we just getting the win, but getting the win with a, you know, with a clean sheet, that also helps to, you know, to relax you, and then you just start knocking it out, because the goal was to,
you
know, to qualify for
the
next stage, and so then you tick off that first box,
and
made
that,
you know, didn't play the greatest game, but, you know, we got the win. So then that breeds confidence into you, knowing that, you know, New Zealand too, or, you know, been to the Olympics a number of times, been to the World Cups a number of times, so a very experienced team that have played together, you know, a number of years, good players as well. So that gave us confidence, you know, going into the second game, knowing that, right, that was a tough game, a real tough game for us to start off with. We came through that test, and then going into the second one, it was like, right, this is a key game, but one that, you know, we're boosted by, you know, the win, the clean sheet, and then the sway of the nation, you know, getting on board. So that was just like, you know, they jumped on the bandwagon, the wave, and that then gave us extra confidence going into the second game.
It was fantastic. I didn't set out prior to the Olympics to go to any of the games, but it was very fortunate that a friend of mine bought a ticket for a game up at Old Trafford. And then I think I went to, I think it was Ghana, Japan at Wembley, and I saw some beach volleyball that friends just had tickets. And I'm really, really glad that I did get an opportunity to go, because seeing it firsthand, I'd have kicked myself afterwards if I'd missed it, because it was just fantastic. Even seeing some of the smaller sports,
yeah,
it just, that buzz is just, it's incredible. It must have been so infectious when you're there as an athlete.
Yeah, I mean, even for us, like, even though that we were based in like Cardiff, you know, if you think about it, the hub was like London for, you know, the track and stuff. But, you know, getting to go to the village, you know, the Olympic village, and getting that tour and getting that experience, and how, like, you know, like how it would be when actually all the athletes are there. And I remember meeting Dame Kelly Holmes and things like that, and just being, because you see them on TV, on telly, and like they're like, for me, the cream of the crop, and at the top of their game and things like that, and just like legends of the sport, and like Team GB Olympians, and, you know, meeting Sir Chris Hoy, and, you know, things like that. You're just thinking, like, wow, it's just like, and, you know, like, I remember Hope always saying, I was like, you know, they're no different to us, but I still see them very differently, because, you know, again, growing up watching the Olympics, you're just in awe for me, and I'm just kicking the ball about. But, you know, so getting that, you know, there's just so many, you know, facets to the Olympics that, you know, outside of it, that you don't even realize, and just experiencing that, the media attention. Maybe it's like, maybe back then, again, it was different because there wasn't so much media attention in the female game. Now it's obviously a lot more, but the Olympics is like no other. I mean, this is worldwide, where it's beamed all across the world, and the numbers that are involved in that is just, it's just incredible.
Did you think about it at the time? Did it make you nervous at all?
Don't think about the time. Obviously, it's just if you think about it, I think you'd get overawed by it, you know. So for me, I just took it back to, like, I'm just playing football. I stay in my zone. It was only, you know, I remember when we got to our hotel in Cardiff, like, you know, the hotel being decorated, like messages of support as we went on. And you just seen pictures of, you know, young girls, and, you know, with the, you know, the British flags and the messages of support, reading through like the clips and the papers and stuff like that. And even afterwards, I remember I've got like a whole, like every single article that was, or I think it was every single article they sent, like, I think it was it Team GB? We got sent like a book of that. But even looking back on that, you're just thinking, wow. Because for me also, like, I wasn't on social media then, because, you know, good or bad, I wasn't on social media, because you don't want, you know, your head to go and, like, I'm in that bubble, I'm here to do a job. and the people that, you know, text messages and things like that, that was like, you know, my circle. So, you know, that's all that mattered to me. You know, it's about staying grounded. But we also got clips of it afterwards and just messages of support in the wave and how it all took off. It was just like, it's just, when you look back, it's just like, wow. So you know that you're doing it for the nation and, you know, everybody's behind you and the home Olympics that you're thinking, you know. But it's bigger and bigger. And then, like I said, it got bigger and bigger till obviously it got to Wembley where, you know, yeah, you know, Brazil and Wembley, which, you know, 70,000 in front of that. So I may have missed out on that, but yeah.
Moving on to that heartbreak, sadly, in, I think it was it game three against Cameroon that you were stretched off.
So yeah, could you say game in the Olympics like that one, but.
Could you tell me a little bit about what happened?
You know, cause I remember, like, it was basically something that I've probably done every single time. I basically, you know, went to plant my stud and then turn, but, you know, my studs haven't caught in the grass. So as I've, so I've slid, as I've kept on turning. So a movement that, you know, I do over and over again. And again, I just slipped. As I've slipped, I've turned, and then that's it. So I've got in the turf, and I just remember, like, thinking, I remember my first thoughts as I'm down on ground that the Cameroon followed us through and goal, and I'm thinking, oh, I hope it's going to kill me here. And but I couldn't get up. And so obviously medical staff came on, did all their stuff, all their tests, whatnot, and just knowing that I couldn't walk off. I don't think I've ever been in a situation where I've never been able to walk off the pitch. So that's the first time ever and the only time I've ever been stretched off. And so, you know, then went down the tunnel, you know, where they've, you know, had, you know, like more time to have a look at it, things like that. But I had no idea, you know, the severity of it. And, you know, we didn't think it was worst case scenario. I've never, ever injured my knee in any way. So I don't know what that feels like or have any ideas about that. Hamstrings, you know, little muscle injury, sure, you'd have an idea. But this was completely new to me. So I was kind of out of my depth and relying on the medical people to kind of, you know, guide me in this way. So after the game, you know, went for, you know, the scans and things like that. So you're just waiting to hear. And then a few hours later, you know, I was in my room and, you know, the medical team came up to me and just kind of let me know, you know, what it was. And I was just thinking, Jesus, like, because you hear about it all the time. I've heard about it, especially when I was in America. I think it was like such a common injury. But just like, I was just like, yeah, I was.
For those that don't know, what was the injury in the end?
So I tore my ACL, my meniscus, and then had an LCL sprain. So three ligaments in my knee. And I remember KB, you know, Karen Badley, she had said that she had heard the pop, because people always talk about hearing the pop when you do it. And I honestly, still to this day, I didn't hear it, still don't know what it sounds like, but she was like, you know, 30, 40 years old. So I was just like, oh, like, so I don't know what it sounds like, but knowing that, you know, not just that one ligament, you know, three ligaments in your knee, and I think at 31, you know, like, you just, like, I start thinking, you know, can I come back from it at that age and things like that? But I remember, like, my first phone calls being to, obviously, my mum. I called Anna Signol and then Joanne Wilson, the physio from Scotland at that time, because then it was a case of, right, like, I'm done. And then within 48 hours, I'm back in Scotland. So for me, then it was like, right, it wasn't like staying in this mindset of wallowing and knowing that my Olympics was done. It was then trying to be like, right, you know, like, it's about, you know, getting the surgery, because it was a case of I could do it anywhere. And it was a no-brainer that obviously I was going to go home, you know, have the, you know, the people from who I know very well, who I trust to do it and guide me in that way to then start my recovery. And then once I got back up the road, it was then, you know, maybe it hit home, you know, sitting down watching the girls against Brazil at Wembley and knowing that, you know, meeting, like, you know, the Royals, David Beckham, things like that. And it was definitely tinged with sadness because, you know, even though that we don't look ahead, you know, when just following the path of beating New Zealand 1-0, beating Cameroon 2-0, and then the big game, like, it doesn't get any bigger, Brazil, Wembley, you know, so it's set up nicely for that. And that was definitely hard to then watch that, see that, but also be happy for the girls because, again, I've been there, seen the preparation. And then, you know, as soon as we got to the quarterfinals, I'd already made the decision that, you know, I wanted to drive down and, you know, go support the girls. And it wasn't about me, you know, I didn't even want to go to the team hotel, things like that, because I didn't want any distraction about my injury and things like that. It was just solely be at the game, you know, watch them, support them, and then, you know.
You deserve that. You deserved it, ultimately. You're still part of the team. You're still part of that squad, very much so. Did it take, how long after London did it take to, for want of a better word, to get over that disappointment?
I feel like everything was a little bit delayed in so many ways, because I think post-Olympics, there was a lot of like post-Olympic events, which was, you know, like had I been, you know, when I look at it, had I been gone through everything and if I was fully fit, I wouldn't have got the chance to experience. So like I went to, obviously came back down to the London for the Olympic parade, which was, you know, on the floats, which was incredible because, you know, just having people, and I've got so many videos and pictures from people hanging outside their windows, people stopping at Starbucks, you know, like things like that, taking pictures, cheering, clapping, you know, meeting like Mo Farah, all the other Olympians also, and like things like that. Then we had the, you know, Scottish one, we had dinners, we had all that. So there's a lot of celebration post-London, you know, post, you know, like post-Olympics, that was just quite incredible that actually I wouldn't have been able to experience, because if I'd been back in Sweden playing, I would have missed all that. So that kind of took away from, you know, like, you know, being on crutches, my surgery, kind of delayed things a little bit. But again, it's one of those things that I'll never get back. So in the grand scheme of things, you know, I'm more than happy with that. So I think once all that died down, so that was a few months after all that died down, and then I could then just get back into like every day, go to physio every day in the cold, dreary weather, and, you know, and then just try to think about, right, you know, attacking the rehab and try to get back.
That must be hard. It's, I guess, for someone that's never played at any sort of proper level outside of a school level, I the only thing I could potentially empathize, or my own experience I could liken it to, would be to coming back off a long holiday that, oh, I'm back to real life. And that you must have been, fell to earth with such a bump afterwards, because after being on such a high, and then not even the low, just the normality of getting back to life.
It wasn't even normal, because for me, like, I hadn't been in Scotland for that long since I was 18. Because obviously I've been abroad that whole time. You know, every time I finished a season in Sweden or in America, I'd be home for maybe a month. So knowing that I'm back kind of living in Scotland, and I'm in Scotland for like, I think 8-9 months, that was weird too, because I've never been home that long. And it was just, like I said, it was like, you know, that, you know, open the door, it's raining, you know, it's just like miserable outside. And it's like, all I've got to do is, you know, rehab, you know, because I'm really used to, you know, training, things like that. And so every day it's the same. But I would say the biggest thing, like, instead of feeling down for myself and the weather and things like that, I remember watching the Paralympic Games, and I'd never seen that ever in my life. So I think, again, off of the, you know, the Olympics and the high of that, it was then watching these amazing Paralympians, like, you know, like swimming. I can't even swim, right? And I'm watching swimmers who have like no arms or no legs swimming and doing it. Like, I'm just thinking, like, that was it. And, you know, I look back and I'm just saying, you know, that's just so inspiring to me, like, you know, for me, because, you know, that was just temporary, you know, my pain is just temporary, you know, and you can overcome it. It was the biggest thing is a mental and emotional roller coaster, because the physical, as an athlete, you know, you fall down, you get back up, but knowing that something as big, for me anyway, as big as 8-9 months, it was that challenge. But knowing that, instead of doubting myself, instead of thinking, will I ever be the same and whatnot, I'm watching these incredible Paralympians, so that I've got that map background to every time that I'm going through a tough day at rehab or whatnot, and try to get down, not to get too down, because, you know, they're on the world stage and they're doing some incredible things. And that to me is just like, I was in awe of them. So that actually helped me to get through my journey and not just be like beat myself up and, you know, just knowing that, you know, I can do this. It's just, you know, being patient, really patient, being at home for that long. But, you know, everything has its challenges, and this was another challenge.
Looking back 9 years on, how do you feel about your time representing Great Britain at the Home Olympics?
Definitely one of joy. I can't take anything but good things from that. You know, people always think, you know, or point out, you know, like my ACL injury. But for me, that, because everyone always has the cliches when things, bad things happen, everything happens for a reason. But that's the last thing you want to hear. But looking back now, in terms of how my journey went after that and how much longer that I played football, and I never thought I'd play that long. So that might have been, you know, like, you know, I look at that as a blessing in so many ways. And so no matter what, the Olympics gave me, you know, the best moments, you know. Even when it was a negative, it turned out to be a positive for the rest of my career. So it's something that, you know, I've got a lot of memories, a lot of joy, even speaking about it, looking at pictures, everything. It's just, it's nothing but, you know, positivity and one experience that I'm glad I took, one that I took with the people that, you know, that were involved in it, being the first, and definitely special.
If you could give any advice to any of the players who are selected for the Tokyo Games, what would it be?
Tokyo Games, just enjoy it. You know, it's such a unique experience, one that you might never get again. And again, just attack it like you'd attack any big game. Don't get overawed or even be on social media and look at what people say. Just stay in your bubble, you know, in your own head. Whatever got you there is a reason why you're there. And just don't deviate from, you know, who you are as a player, and just stay in the moment.
Thank you. Iffy, I'm mindful that we've kept you for well over an hour now. And I think I said to you before we started recording that I'm pretty sure we've got 30 minutes of good conversation here. But you've given us some really interesting insights into such a unique experience. And you talk about being in awe of people like Mo Farah and Dame Kelly Holmes. Kind of feel the same about yourself, to be honest. It's an absolute pleasure to speak to yourself. The way that you're inspired by some of the Paralympians, people like myself, fans of women's football, we feel the same about you, to be honest.
Thank you. No, I mean, I like, now that I've finished, I do enjoy talking about it. I don't do it very often, you know, but when people ask me, I think it's important that, again, I never did a lot of interviews when I played. I just stuck to playing football. But I think being on the other side and the coaching side, and speaking to the players that I coach, going through the experiences. I think when players have gone through those experiences, my biggest thing is sharing that. If I can give back to players in my situation, if I can inspire players, and just by talking about, you know, the good times, the bad times, whatever it is, give them any kind of advice, then I think that's the whole part about, you know, inspiring the next generation, is about, you know, telling them that, you know, sharing your stories, your experiences with that. And so I enjoy doing that. I enjoy helping, you know, your younger players, and any advice, any experience, I'm always happy to help at any time. And I think that's so important, because I've had my time, I've enjoyed it, but it's in
I know you've got me at 37 and Daisy at 15 years old, so it's going to be quite frightening. I think we'll probably end up seeing Daisy as part of the Sky Sports team doing the WSL, won't we, Daisy?
Yeah, I mean, at 15, I couldn't have done that, but, you know, start young. But, you know, I mean, look at Alex Scott. I mean, if I look at when rooming with her at the Olympics, and obviously I played with her at Boston Breakers, and just watching her journey, like wow. But never in doubt, because Alex is, you know, such a great person, such a good speaker, so enthusiastic about, you know, what she does. And, you know, so seeing her thrive and go on to bigger and better things, like, it's just, it's really good to see, and, you know, happy for her. So
she's just a game changer. Yeah, she's just changed the game for everyone. It's fantastic.
It's brilliant to see. So, you know, so everybody's got their part to play in everybody's future, and so.
Thank you for chatting with us. Good luck with your coaching.
Cool. Thanks for having me. You know, it's been a blast to reminisce about, you know, 2012. and look forward to the upcoming Olympics and the selections.
And here is a job going at the Scottish national team. Any interest?
It's too cold for me now, so.
Yeah, who leave Miami for that? But again, thank you very much for giving up your time to talk to us. It's been a real pleasure and a real real insight. And thank you.
No problem. Have a good night, and good luck with everything.
Thank you. You take care.
You too.